This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Somebody will throw the race card up on the table, or they're race baiters or whatever. And you do exactly the opposite.
All we're trying to do is get America to see the humanity in people of color. We're not asking for anything special.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Fill in the Blanks. Really special day. You'll understand why. I'm here with my good friend, Attorney Ben Crump. Now, he is referred to as Black America's Attorney General. Through a steadfast dedication to justice and service, Ben has established himself as one of the nation's foremost lawyers and advocates for social justice. His legal acumen has ensured that most of the people that are marginalized in American society are truly protected by their nation's contract with its constituency. Now, he is listed amongst the most influential people of 2021 by Time 100, Ebony Magazine's Power 100, Most Influential African Americans, the National Trial Lawyers' Top 100 Lawyers. Now, let me say that again. The top 100 trial lawyers in America and the 2014 NNPA Newsmaker of the Year. Ben's tireless advocacy has led to legislation preventing excessive force and developing implicit bias training and policies. Now, that is a hell of an accomplishment, and we're going to talk about how all of that has come to pass. So welcome to Ben Crump. Ben, thanks for coming and doing this.
Hey, thank you for having me, Dr. Phil.
Well, we've been working together a long time.
Hey, man, it's hard to believe 10 years since Trayvon Martin.
Is that something?
Yeah, man.
Listen, people always see you in the middle of a firestorm, because when people are at the darkest hour of their life, they call Ben Crump. Nobody calls you to let you know how well things are going. Really, they call you at the darkest hour of their life when something has happened, someone has been victimized, they've been hurt, they've been in a run-in with the police and it's gone really bad. They're overwhelmed by the system and they call you. People always see you in the middle of the firestorm, and I'm going to talk about some of that, but I want people to take a few minutes to get to know Ben. How'd you get in the law?
You know, Dr. Phil, when I was 9 years old, growing up in Lumberton, North Carolina, a little small rural southern town, being raised by my single mother who worked two jobs. In the morning, she would wash hotel laundry and clean rooms, and then she would come home and put some food on the table and then go to second shift at the Converse shoe factory and work second shift.
Wow.
And did everything in her power to keep food on the table, a roof over our head, and hope in our hearts. And everything I am to be, is because of my mother and her sacrifices for us. And so when I was in the ninth grade, they had Brown versus the Board of Education with school desegregation. And you remember the Supreme Court edit was with all deliberate speed. Well, all deliberate speed in Southern North Carolina did not happen until 1978, from 1954. And so they then integrated the schools and they took us little Black children from South Lumberton, literally across the tracks to the north side of town, which was the white community that had the newer schools, the newer technology, newer facilities,
right,
new books, everything. And I just remember one day, Dr. Phil, on the school bus, coming back across the tracks. And when we got to South Lumberton, I observed the dilapidated buildings, like our little elementary school falling apart. You saw the broken down cars on the road. You saw the, you know, houses that had boards on the windows that were vacant. And I just kept thinking to myself, I wonder why people on a certain side of town seem to have it so good and people on our side of town seem to have it so hard. And my mother told me the reason we got to go to the new school with the new books, new facilities, was because a man named Thurgood Marshall and Brown versus the Board of Education. And from that moment, I made a decision. When I grow up, I want to be like Attorney Thurgood Marshall and be able to fight for people in my community and people who look like me to have an equal opportunity at the American promise of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And from that day to this one, I wake up with the same objective.
Well, it comes out. You feel it in everything you say, everything you do. And I can attest in working with you for over a decade that when you deal with Ben Crump, what you see is what you get. I work with a lot of lawyers that they've got their television persona and they'll put on a show. Then when they're off camera, the passion's not there. They don't have that empathy for their clients. You're that one person I can say that absolutely is not true of. You are the authentic, real deal. And every time I've dealt with you with your clients, they know it. I know it. Anybody that deals with you know that you genuinely care about the people that you deal with.
You know, Dr. Phil, I think we've been blessed. A lot of us have been blessed for God to give us a purpose for living. You know, he gave me the education, the law school degrees, this great legal team I have worked with us. And shame on us if we don't try to use the blessings to help others. And so I know sometimes, you know, everybody's not going to love you. You understand that going in, but you say, hopefully they will at least respect me for trying to, you know, follow my calling in life and live up to what I believe is to be right. And I'm not saying I know everything, but I'm saying I want to do the things I believe in my heart are right to do. And so that's what I hope comes across. And it's funny, Dr. Phil, it's been 10 years, man. I can't believe since we did the Trayvon Martin show, and so much has happened, but it's still the same. We're fighting for all of our children to have a better world. And I'm never trying to be anything I'm not. I'm a country lawyer, and I'm fighting for marginalized people.
When you opened your practice, and of course, you had to go through college and law school, all of that, what is the biggest obstacle you've had to overcome, you think, in getting where you are today?
You know, when I think about the challenges, I think it's not so much what I had to overcome per se, but how America had to finally acknowledge that there were implicit biases, if not outright racism and discrimination. You know, when we were younger, we would go into courtrooms and we would fight for our clients and almost get put in jail ourselves because the court system, everybody said that, you know, black people really didn't matter. We were insignificant, kind of irrelevant, certainly thought we were inferior. And so the whole time I'm going up to the judge and the jury and I'm challenging them saying, well, I know you can recite the Declaration of Independence, but what I want to know is if you believe in what the Declaration of Independence says. Do you really believe it when you say we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equally, that they're endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights that amongst them are life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Well, if you do, that applies to black people too, brown people too, Native Americans. You got to accept that we are all equal. And if you don't accept that, then this dead black boy who was shot by the police, we've lost this trial before we begin. And so you have that real conversation with the judges, and some of them don't like that. And I'm saying, well, I don't know how to tone it down, Judge, because my client lost his life, and we're trying to make sure that somebody acknowledged his life mattered.
If you're voir dire in a jury and you've got a white defendant over there, and you got a white judge for sure, and you got a white defendant, and you're facing a jury, and you're having to find those people that have their mind made up just simply because the victim here was black and you're black, when you're talking to them on voir dire, do they out themselves? Do they hide? Do they try to lay behind the log so they can control the situation after? And how does it feel to stand in front of them knowing that you've got some enemies up there purely because of the color of your skin?
That's a great question, Dr. Phil. And you literally have to get yourself mentally prepared to do that, because most of the time you're going to be facing unanimously, if not predominantly, all white juries. And you have to almost fight initial battle before you start fighting the case battle that you're there for. What do I mean? Trayvon is probably the best example in the world. Because of the stereotypes on young black men, they said Trayvon couldn't just be a young kid walking home with a bag of Skittles and a can of iced tea. He just couldn't be a young kid talking on the telephone to his high school friend. You know, he had to be somebody doing something nefarious. You know these black kids, how they are. So you have to first convince them of the battle that, hold on, our children are like your children, and we love our children just like you love your children. So doing voir dire, it's that tug of war going on, and it's a lot of them laying, behind the door, trying not to show their true identity or their true beliefs. And so, Dr. Phil, and I know that question is taken only from somebody who's been in courtrooms, and so, because you have to, we call them rat killers. You have to kill the rats in that jury so you can just have a fair trial. You ain't asking for nothing special. We just want you to give us the same consideration that you're going to give our opponent. And so we used to that, and that is something we've gotten really good at. That's why I always ask that Declaration of Independence question, and I go down through each witness, and the judge, the other side would object, and I'll say, well, Judge, we got to ask this question before we can move on, because if not, we can't have a fair trial here. And even though the judges sometimes get upset at us, they at least relent and let us do it, because they understand, too, the goal is to get a fair jury, or we won't have a good trial.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
Apes hunt humans.
That is wrong.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And people forget sometimes that we don't pick juries, we're deselecting jurors. And so you're trying to get those out of there that you know are just waiting to get even, waiting to run their agenda. And if you don't get them out, you're done before you start.
You're absolutely right. And Dr. Phil, I will tell you, I used to go on the conservative news shows because I do understand a lot of my jury pools are not just going to come from, you know, multicultural communities. A lot of them going to come from conservative communities. So we got to try to frame the narrative. And this is what I think I've been able to do successfully in the last 10, 20 years, is start trying to frame the narrative that we are not presumed guilty. You got to at least give us some presumption of innocence. When I would go on the network, there was a certain commentator, and I won't call his name, but he would say to me, and he was one of the top-rated guys, and he'll get on, we just buddy-buddy before we go on air. And then when we go on air, he would say, Ben, now every police shooting case I did, he would say, now, I just don't understand, Ben. Are you trying to say that all police officers are bad? Because most of them are good. And I would collect myself for a second and I say, now, are you trying to say all black people are bad? Because wouldn't you agree most of them are good? We can't have one person or one entity or the other have the high ground on morality. We got to say that there's some good in the best of us and some good in the worst of us and some bad in the best of us. That's what people are. And we have to acknowledge that. And you know, I digress for a second. I think, Dr. Phil, when I brought Trayvon's family on, both them Jean's family on, you know, Ahmaud Arbery family, all these families, and you would interact with them. The one thing I always appreciated about you, you saw the humanity in them. And that's all we're trying to do, is get America to see the humanity in people of color. We're not asking for anything special.
That's the thing. People always talk about somebody will throw the race card up on the table or they're race baiters or whatever. And you do exactly the opposite. You're trying to get it off the table. You're not in there trying to play the race card. You're saying, oh, I'm wanting to see even playing field.
Yeah.
All I want you to recognize is I have a mother here that has lost a child. A child. She held that child just like you held your child. She took pride in that child. She laughed. She giggled with that child. And she's now crying over that child. I know when we had Trayvon's mother here, we had Ahmaud Arbery's mother, listening and seeing you interact, you would see the audience change and move because they realize, but for the grace of God, go I. It's a mother-son. It's not anything different. It's just the same. And you have to do all the work to get there before you even start dealing with the facts.
And it's so interesting. I was here in Los Angeles, and yesterday we were having a press conference where this man and this woman got killed horribly. The police were pursuing in a high-speed pursuit case, and it was over a traffic stop. They said the guy was speeding, and they did a 70-mile-per-hour high-speed chase through South Central, the black community in Los Angeles, and killed these two innocent people who were just driving through the intersection. And the one thing I kept saying to myself, Dr. Phil, is this isn't just about the Harris family, who was the woman in the car, or the Keys family, the man in the car. This is about every citizen in Los Angeles, California, because but by the grace of God, that could have been anybody who was just innocently driving down the road. And we kept making the point, when you look at the statistics, they seem to engage in these high-speed pursuits more in the black community than other communities. And so how can we get them to see what's the crux of the matter? You got to put them in the shoes of saying, well, what happens if you were driving down the road that day and you just happen to be in a section of town that the police say, we don't follow our own policies because they are irrelevant or they insignificant. That's over and over what you're trying to do is say, just at least for a second, give consideration to the other side of the coin.
Yeah, the collateral risk here is the same as the collateral risk in Beverly Hills or Bel Air.
Yep.
You got to weigh it the same.
Yes,
sir. Human life's a human life.
A human life is human life, yeah.
When you decided to really commit your life to this and start representing these people that had no way to navigate the terrain, it had to feel right when you stepped into it. It had to feel right, but you had to feel pressure too, because these people, when you show up and take their case, you're it for them. We know that the church is often the center of the Black community and they have that support. But in terms of fighting back in the system, it's Ben Crump.
You know, it's to whom much is given, much is expected. And I do feel that way. I tell you, Dr. Phil, and this gets kind of deep, and this is why I probably need to talk to you more, my friend. People often ask me, how do you deal with it, Ben, all of the stress of the constant death and loss and tragedy of it all? And I would say, because I study history and I study Thurgood Marshall, my personal hero, and he would talk about how you have to compartmentalize stuff because you can't give way to emotion when you're there with the families trying to be strong for everybody and make sense out of something that makes no sense at all, that they're going to now have to bury their child who were killed by people who were supposed to protect them in many cases. And so I'm trying to be strong and I'm compartmentalizing because, as Justice Marshall said, if you're not strong and trying to keep it together to get justice, then you can't prevent some of the future injustices from happening, some of the future hashtags, the next Trayvons and George Floyds. And so I keep trying to compartmentalize, but in this Netflix documentary where they kept the camera on me, it got, the director did a good thing of showing vulnerable moments of when I was by myself after we had met with the families. And I found myself, Dr. Phil, and I never knew this, I found myself always just rubbing my head and rubbing my temples and so forth. And I kind of conclude that must be the physical manifestation of the mental anguish from yet talking to another family who is doing stuff through the unnatural order of things, where they're having to bury their children. No parent, and I've seen it 100 times, you just don't even fathom that. You know it's possible, but you always believe your children are going to bury you in your heart.
Yeah, I always tell them, everyone that you've brought here and allowed us to tell the story, first thing I always say to them is, one thing you won't hear me say is, I know how you feel. Because if you haven't been there and buried a child, you can't know. You can empathize as best you can, but you can't know what they're going through. How much they blame themselves, how much they feel like, if I had just said, they play the what if game. What if I had taken Trayvon to the store? What if I had picked up some things for him before? What if I had done this? What if I'd have done that? What if we lived somewhere? They play the what if game till it drives them crazy. You can get them a verdict, you can get them a judgment, you can get them a settlement.
The first page of a book never tells the full story. And those news alerts and headlines, like the ones we get on our phones, don't even scratch the surface of what the story is really all about. Stories are like people, multi-layered and complex. It takes some digging to find the truth, but when we find it, it can change our world. We like to dig. The news on Merritt Street. Essential television.
Lauren, we are sisters.
That's true.
And we host a celebrity-obsessed podcast called Pop Apologists.
We also love Taylor Swift. Chandler, how are you managing to cope while we await Taylor's new album?
Look, I want to be put into a medically induced coma and wake up on April 19th, but I'm not sure my insurance is going to cover it.
Join us on our pop culture podcast, Pop Apologists, where we will be dishing on all things celebrity news and deep diving every word and note of Taylor's new album.
Pop Apologists.
Pop Apologists.
But you can't get them justice. You can just get them some measure.
Accountability. Yeah.
You can't get that child back for them. And it helps, and you got to feel good when you do, and I know they do. They feel like they've somehow pushed back and made somebody be accountable. You know, it was February 26th of 2012 when Trayvon Martin was killed by George Zimmerman, and he was just 17 years old. So it has been 10 years since that happened. That case changed you. Why did it change you so much?
You know, the reason Trayvon changed me, as I've often said, Dr. Phil, is, and this is a very hard pill to swallow. Most black people in America had, even though we hadn't gotten used to it, we had become accustomed to the police could kill our children, and you know, they often got away with it. But with Trayvon and this stand your ground law, it said any Tom, Dick, or Harry could kill our children. But as long as they said, oh, I felt in fear of my life, the law said you can go home and sleep in your bed at night. And you said, man, hold on. How is it you can kill my child who's unarmed and your word is the gospel and you get to go and sleep in your bed at night? That, I think, was what made Trayvon Martin this global phenomenon where people said, that's a bridge too far, America. You can't, at some point, you got to say, our children get the right to get equal justice too. Because we just all said if the racial dynamics were different, and that was a young 17-year-old white kid, there is no way his killer would have got to go home and sleep in his bed that night.
You know, 2 years later, Tamir Rice was shot and killed in Cleveland, Ohio. And he was, what, 12?
12 years old.
12 years old.
Playing in the playground by himself.
Yeah.
And you look at that video, the police rolled up on him in less than 1.5 seconds. They rolled down the window and shot that kid. Nobody went to jail. Nobody was charged. I mean, it's enough to make you want to holler when you think about it.
Pretty hard to imagine a second and a half and a child is dead on a playground. Now, he was holding a toy gun, but these are difficult times when that is the default response. What do you say to yourself about that?
Well, what it tells me is we got to go fight harder, because what I believe in my heart, and I will believe it until the day I die, we will win this war for liberty and justice for all. The enemies of equality will not win this war. It's the only thing that keeps me going. I believe that we are going to have a better world for all our children.
Do you think progress is being made?
You know, when you think about the past year, you have to acknowledge we are making progress. George Floyd, first time in Minneapolis that police officers were convicted of second-degree murder in their history for killing a black person, killing anybody. Ahmaud Arbery, who you talked to, his parents, Marcus and Wanda, and, I mean, he was lynched for jogging while black, and that was in the deep south of Georgia. You had the first trial was 11 white, 1 black juror, and they convicted the lynch mob. So you have to know that we are making progress, but, you know, it's like everything. It's a journey. On your journey, sometimes you're going to take a step forward, and then there are going to be times when you take a step back. But you just always have to keep your eyes focused, eyes on the prize. You just got to keep trying to move forward no matter what happens.
What's the most important thing that needs to happen to really level the playing field? I was talking to a young black man not long ago, and he quoted somebody having said that when you get stopped by the police at night, it's the most dangerous 5 minutes of your life. And his parents had talked to him about it. And I remember having two young black guys on the show that had been in a confrontation with the police at a fast food restaurant, and their parents were upset and they had gotten into a fracas. And I said, let me tell you something. I'll tell you young men something. When a cop confronts you on the street, you need to respect the badge and do exactly what you're told, because your job is to get home alive. And if you got a problem with what they are doing or said or did, you need to pick your battles and your battlefield. Amen. And you go file a complaint and follow up on it, but you don't pick that battle on the street at night, unarmed, with somebody that's got a badge and a gun. Get home alive and pick that battle up tomorrow by filing a complaint or whatever. Don't pick that fight that night. And the parents were just like, my God, thank you. Because yeah, they, you know, they're proud and they want to stand up for themselves, and that's fine, but not then. That's not a battle you're going to win.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to say, get home alive.
Yeah.
And let's deal with this tomorrow. Is that good advice?
No, that's great advice, Dr. Phil. I'm a tell you, I'm going to give you credit. I'm going to quote that a lot. I said, that's not the time to pick the battle, and you don't pick that battlefield when you're on the side of a dark street at night where you know if you move a certain way, they shoot and kill you. And the Supreme Court and everybody say they justify because they were in fear of their life. And, you know, it's the subjective fears of young black and brown people that you just scratch your head and say, man, what is it about a black person that makes you shoot first and ask questions later? And you see videos of young white kids doing all manner of things to police, and they always give them the benefit of the doubt, the benefit of consideration, and the benefit of possibility. And so I think about my law partner, Chris O'Neill, was a police officer 10 years before he became a civil rights attorney. And we so often talk about, police see things differently a lot. And he educates me, because I look at it and it's just so clear to me that this was wrong and completely unjustified. But he will say, well, the police, they don't know what situation they're coming into. And he says that. So I understand that. And so your advice is best. Try, even though it should not be our children's responsibility, our community members' responsibility, since they aren't the professionals, the police officers are the professionals, but try your best to de-escalate whatever the situation is, because the goal is to live, to not be killed, and then have other people marching for you as a hashtag. And that, you're right, that's the goal.
That's what I was wanting the parents to say to their black sons. Get home alive. And these young men were saying, but we didn't do anything. I get it.
Yeah.
I understand. I don't want you to be a right fighter, because I want you to walk out of there, not get carried out of there. Go file a complaint. How many millions of dollars did the New York Police Department pay last year settling claims
yep.
for misconduct?
Yep.
Get paid. Don't get dead. Get home alive.
And one of the things, well, two things on that point, Dr. Phil. One thing that I keep talking about in the documentary is I want to make it, I want to raise the value of black life in America so much where it becomes financially unsustainable for police to keep shooting black and brown people in the back, you know, killing us unjustifiably. I cannot understand for the life of me why white police officers think it's the most dangerous thing in the world when a black person is running away from them. I'm like, why would you shoot him in the back and they running away from you? But it's like a cliche almost, Dr. Phil, that, you know, a black man being shot in the back, I was in fear of my life, but they running away from you. How does that make any sense? And then I go back to doing the comparisons. I say, why is it that even though black men make up only 6% of the population in America, you shoot them, you know, when you look at people shot in the back, we like 85%, 90%. You never seem to shoot white men in the back. You don't fear them when they're running away from you. So it's implicit bias, and we got to constantly deal with that. And I'm not saying that it's just the police. I just think, well, and one of the things I learned from you over the years, all of us have implicit biases. We just constantly got to keep working on them so that we don't act upon them.
Yeah, but you don't act upon them, whatever they are, by making a conscious decision not to. And that's what you're doing when you're going through your voir dire with a white jury. You're putting it on their radar where they will make a conscious decision to say, I'm not going to let this control me here. It's been pointed out to me, and I am going to make a conscious decision to not let this be a filter that I look at this evidence through, that I look at this case through. And if you put it at the front of their mind, and you don't do it in an accusatory way, you just do it in a, let's just be honest with each other here, then people can make allowances for it. They can make adjustments for it. That's what we need to do. And I think sometimes it's done in such a in-your-face, hostile way mm-hmm. that they get backlash, they get resentment against it. And that's the last thing
yep.
that we want. What we want is people to really say, you know, that's a good point. I need to consider that, which is what you're doing in front of the jury.
Yeah, and I, you know, I'm a country boy, and I learned a long time ago from my grandmother that you can get more bees with honey yeah. than vinegar. So you go out and you talk to that jury, and you don't accuse them of anything. You just try to make them be rational. Look at this from a rational view. And I think when you think about Trayvon to George Floyd in those 10 years, you continue to learn and you evolve. Your style get better. You are more selective and discreet in how you communicate themes and so forth. Because you got to think, Dr. Phil, man, you and I did Trayvon, and you know that the country was completely polarized. But then you come to George Floyd, and you want to believe we made progress because you saw as many young white people out there marching saying, I can't breathe until we get justice for George Floyd, as there were young black people. And so that tells me that our message is starting to get through. But we got to keep it up, and we got to keep it louder because the hashtags have not stopped.
No, there's no way that a human life is worth a lesson. And you hear people say, well, look, he was no angel. But let me tell you, there wasn't anything that he may have done that was a capital offense.
Yeah.
We know that for damn sure.
Yeah.
Thank God that we've got body cams and things like that where people can see what took place.
Thank God.
That's a game changer, isn't it?
I digress, Dr. Phil. I don't want to be like the people on the show the other day trying to take control of your show, but I at least want to say this. Body cameras have been a game changer for decades. Black people would say the police are brutalizing me, or they are, you know, they shot us unjustly. And nobody would believe them. Nobody would believe them, but you know, we now have these videos that you say, hold on, you got to look at this video, and you at least got to acknowledge that Ahmaud was just jogging. He was jogging while black. He did nothing wrong to provoke this. And if it were not for video, they never would have been brought to justice. And even with video, it took us 9 months.
Right.
But you know, it's funny because when we were on your show, Dr. Phil, you remember it had just, the video had been released, and then you were gracious enough to help us raise the consciousness level of this young man being lynched for jogging while black. And the video that America has saw, we the people who made them finally arrest this lynch mob, was seen by the police on day one.
Yeah.
They saw exactly what we saw, and they said, we okay with it.
You know, that's bothersome. And I know so many men and women in law enforcement that were so appalled by what they saw that it just turned their stomach.
Yeah. Yeah.
It made them furious
yeah.
to see that. Just made them furious to see it because everybody paints them with that brush.
Yep.
And that's not who they are. It's not the way they are.
And that is the constant struggle because I think about George Floyd. You know, you saw all four of those officers and you said, hopefully one of them would have had the humanity to say, hey, man, just take your knee off his neck. Everybody in that street was saying, you're killing them. You're killing them. Everybody could see it. Seems like the professionals who were trained to understand it. And so that tells me that it's not just about training. They got to have empathy for their fellow human beings.
There are some people that just shouldn't be in that job because, let's think about it. By the time that it happened, that was May 20. By the time that had happened, Ahmaud Arbery had happened, Breonna Taylor had happened, Tamir Rice had happened.
Michael Brown Ferguson
had happened. At that point, a law enforcement officer has got to know, you know what? Everybody standing around here has got a camera. Everybody's got audio. Everybody's hearing them say what they're saying, which means this is foreseeable.
Mm-hmm.
Not only is it wrong, it's foreseeable. And all I got to do is move a little bit and set this gentleman up and put him in the car and we're out of here. But to not do that, something's seriously wrong. His problem-solving skills are bad.
You can't even, and you're the expert here, Dr. Fear, but you have to say, what is going through your mind when everybody is telling you you're killing him and you put your hands in your pocket and keep your knee on his neck? But not 1 minute, not 2 minutes, not 3 minutes, not 4 minutes, not 5 minutes, not 6 minutes, not 7 minutes, not 8 minutes, but over 9 minutes. And I always intentionally do that. Hopefully your listening audience will say, hold on, we just used about 10 seconds. This man was almost 10 minutes on his neck and still wouldn't move.
And clearly, at some point 7 minutes ago, ceased to be any kind of threat, if there was ever a threat.
Yeah.
It's impossible to make any sense out of. It's impossible to make any sense.
And I will say this, I give a lot of credit to the Minneapolis Police Department. I saw something I had never seen in my 25 years of practicing law. I saw the police officers come into that courtroom in Minnesota and they testified against one of their fellow officers. And it was kind of profound, even though we shouldn't have been so shocked by it. But we were shocked because police, you know, they never passed the blue wall and testify against each other, no matter how much. They would always say to Black people in our community, well, when you see something, people do something bad, say something, tell somebody. You know, and they would say that because they would always talk about, oh, well, young Black people said we're not going to snitch and so forth. And so they had these whole big campaigns. If you see something, somebody doing something wrong or criminal, tell on them. And I would always say, why don't you show us how to do it, police? And they never would until George Floyd. And it was historical.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. What do you think about this defund the police movement that spun up out of this?
You know, I think that how you title something can kill it quicker than anything. The great civil rights leader Malcolm X said, a label can kill you quicker than a bullet. And he talked about, you know, you getting, and we'll talk about convicted felons, all these labels they put on young people of color. But I think what they're saying, what I want to believe they're saying is we can't just put everything into policing and not put stuff into after school care, not put stuff into mental health awareness and mental health crisis intervention officials and so forth. And so that's what they should have been saying, talking about let's spread the resources out to be community partners versus saying, oh, let's just take all the money from the police budget because they're not doing any good for us. No, no, we need police. Police have a vital role that they serve in our society. And so you would never hear me saying defund the police. What I will say is, how can we reimagine community safety? How can we imagine public safety? That's what we need to be identifying it as.
Well, I've talked to a lot of Black business owners in communities, and they don't want less police. They want their businesses protected. They don't want to be robbed, accosted. They want protection. And they just don't want to be afraid of the people that are protecting them. So, first off, I think defund was the wrong word. Defunding never happened. They may have taken $1 million from this department, but then they spent it in overtime. And if it went down, the whole city budget went down. And now they're talking about refunding. But the whole point to me is you've got to get back to doing two things. One is community relations.
Mm-hmm.
You put officers back on the beat where they're walking the streets and meeting the people and knowing them and shaking their hands and understanding who this young man is and who that young man is and all, then you really have community relations. It's not just some stranger rolling up in a squad car and shooting somebody in 1.5 seconds. Then the other is, it's not about taking money away from the police, it's about putting more money into certain areas, because what you say is exactly right. If you put money into mental health, if you put money into the community, there are violence clusters in communities, and it is very clustered. You go into certain neighborhoods, and there might be a 28 square block neighborhood. Violence clusters within even two or three blocks within that neighborhood. That's where all the bad actors are. And you can go in and focus on these micro clusters, and you don't even have to go drop the hammer there. You can go in and talk to those young men and offer them alternatives, give them some choices and some education and help. There's so much that can be done, but you've got to have police for what's happening right now today. If you have a home invasion today, you want a cop to show up today. But this is stuff that can be done that can help 6 months from now and a year from now. We need to do both. We need to have police, and we need to have people working in the neighborhoods so we don't need so many police.
Yeah. And what you really want is a community partner in the police. For instance, I think what you said about walking the beat, being able to know the people who you are assigned to, that's huge, because I think a lot of it is ignorance. Ignorance of people, you don't know them. But if I knew Arthur, I knew Chris, and I knew their son or their daughter, and I came up on a situation, I'm less likely now to have my guards up that I got to shoot so fast, because, no, I've interacted with Arthur and Chris, and we've coached the police athletic league because they used to do those things in the community, and we have to get back to that. I mean, you get to know everybody in the high schools and the middle schools, all those young people, because during the summer, while they're out of school, you come and coach the basketball team, or you coach the, you know, little league football team. And it makes a world of difference, because now you got people who really know that young kid, and they may stray. I'm not saying that that's the end all, but you have some connection to them, that you see them as a person that's worthy to try to invest in versus a person who I see as a menace to society.
Yeah. Well, I've walked the beat with the cops in Washington Heights and in Harlem and New York City, and there'd be a lot of street vendors out there. We walk by one of them, and they'll say, hey, Officer Nelson, Jackson just ran by here and stole two bottles of orange juice. And they walk another half block, and there'll be Jackson sitting there, and they say, hey, get your butt up and take those back down there. It's not about putting him in jail. It's not about arresting him. I mean, the guy's suffering from some mental problems. Get up and take those back down there and leave her alone. It's solved right there.
Yep.
It's not about arresting, putting him in jail, increasing incarceration. They solve it right there. Say, don't make me come back down. Okay, I'm sorry. And it's over.
Yeah.
That's what happens when you know everybody and you're walking the beat.
And I think, Dr. Phil, the solution can't always to pull my gun and shoot.
No.
I mean, that's what I struggle with. So many times you see these. There was one in San Bernardino, Rob Adams, the kid running away again. And you like, man, why shoot? It's all on video. Like, why do you have to shoot? Why is that the solution every time?
And if you're a cop, why would you do that? Because you know this is on video.
And that's the thing. And I don't want to get too political, but you think about the great restraint they showed on January 6th. Just great restraint. Man, why can't black people ever get some of that kind of consideration?
Yeah. Yeah, you would think, wouldn't you?
Yeah. I mean, hey, I have to say this because I wouldn't be being Crump if I didn't, Dr. Phil. Can you imagine if that was Black Lives Matter on January 6th?
Yeah, no, that'd be a different situation.
Oh, man, they would have shot so many people.
Do you think it's fear and ignorance of just not knowing the culture, not knowing the people?
I think it's what you said first and foremost. Fear. The people plan on our fear. The least common denominator amongst us. They want to look at not what brings us together, but what keeps us separated. And they play on that fear for whatever reasons. It don't make sense to me why people would let themselves be manipulated by some Spengali who just keeps saying, oh, you can't let people be equal because that means it's going to be worse for you. Now, why can't we try to say, Jesse Jackson used to always say this, he said that they said, when they were talking about integrating baseball, they said, well, if we let blacks and Hispanics come into Major League Baseball, it would bring down the quality of the game. When Reverend Jackson said the reality was we didn't know how good baseball could be until we let everybody play the game.
You know, I grew up in athletics because we were really poor, and that was my currency. That's how I fit in. It was athletics. And all of the teams that I played on were half black, half white. And that's how I got to know the different races. It took away all the mystery. And I just think that's such an important part of just interacting and getting to know. It took away all the mystery. There was no fear. And it was two ways. It absolutely took it away from a very early age.
Yeah, and I want to go back, Dr. Phil. You asked me something before. You said, what do you think is the thing we should do, a possible solution? And Arthur and Chris and I, we were at a panel, the people on my team, because it's always a team effort, and I always want to tell people it's never us, we. It's not Big Crump. It's a whole team of us. And we were at a panel discussion, and I heard a young man say something profound. He said there was a book called Upstream. And he said that the gist of the book is this. You had this black guy walking along downriver, just walking, and he saw this young black kid in the river screaming and going under, drowning. And he jumped in the river. And he saved his life. And he said, man, I'm happy I was there to save this young black child's life. And he said, as soon as he felt it himself, he saw another black kid, a second black kid, screaming out in the river. And he was yelling for help, and he was going under drowning. And he jumped in the river, and he saved that kid's life. And then he said, I was happy I was there because this kid would have drowned had I not been there. As soon as he was patting himself on the back, Dr. Phil, he said he heard a third young black kid in the river screaming and asking for help and coming down river. He jumped in the river and he saved that kid. And then he said, what the hell I want to know is who keep throwing all these black kids in the river? And he said, we can't wait to be dealing with the issue downstream. We got to go upstream and prevent them from throwing so many of the black kids in the river. And so the key is prevention and all these social ills, whether it's policing, mass incarceration, whatever. We got to try to deal with the problems before they get downstream.
What a great way to say it.
Yeah.
You know, what a great way to say it. And if the country listens, it'll be so much more economical, so much more effective.
Amen.
And think of what a talent pool is being wasted by not harvesting these young black minds that are going astray when they could be contributing so much in terms of being doctors, engineers, brilliant minds that aren't being harvested because they're not getting the opportunity.
Yeah. And they're not getting the equal opportunity. And that's all you want is an equal chance. And I always keep saying that we ain't asking for nothing special. Just let us have that equal opportunity, the American dream. That's all anybody's asking for in this country.
Yeah. Too much waste. So much talent, too much waste. And you're a good example.
Yeah. I mean, the statistics never said I was supposed to be one of the most influential people in the world. I was supposed to be in a $10 hour job, in prison or dead.
Yeah, it's just tenacity that kept you from doing it and focusing on Thurgood Marshall instead of somebody else.
Exactly. I had a praying grandma.
Well, if you want to know more about Ben Crump, all you got to do is Google his name and you'll find out. But go to Netflix. The documentary is Civil, C-I-V-I-L, Civil. And it's already been looked at by 20 million plus people. You'll learn a lot about who Ben Crump is. I know him. I've known him for over a decade. He is a good man. I would trust him with my back 100 out of 100 times. And if you get to know him, you will too. You'll see him on my show every chance I can get him here to talk about things that matter to people who care. He is a social warrior. He is a civil rights lawyer. He's doing things that matter, and he's doing it in a rational and reasonable way. He's helping people that, but for him, they would be left to their own devices. Ben, I know you got to catch a red eye out of here. Thank you for coming and spending time with me today.
I love you, brother.
I'll see you soon. Love you too, man.